they own houses in London and Monaco, and they can travel freely and they go on holiday. They're like us, and they can exert this level of evil on innocent people.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to work in a war zone? Our guest today is Richard Sharp, the CEO of Frontier Operations.
You know, we keep saying this is one man. It's not, because we see the actions of those soldiers every day. And there is following orders, and then there is doing the other stuff.
Welcome to the Conflict Doctor podcast. I'm Rebecca Nicholson, a PhD in conflict analysis and resolution. On this podcast, we talk about the intersection between personal and societal conflict. Richard's company, Frontier Operations, enables people working in war zones to conduct their work safely. He works with the Ukraine government, humanitarian organizations, philanthropists, outside governments, nonprofit organizations, and private companies. Today, our topic is Amnesty International's report on Ukraine. Amnesty International has a historic reputation of their unbiased reporting of conflict zones. However, according to Richard, what he's seeing on the ground and his experience in military operations says that this report is far from neutral.
We are seeing weaponized rape and weaponized murder across the whole of that conflict zone.
Richard has also worked in disaster response. He was the former CEO of REACT, and REACT is an organization that repurposes the skills of former military. In disaster zones, they would go into the areas that you can't get into. They would do the impossible. They would provide food and relief and life-saving support to people who were in the most difficult areas that were otherwise unreachable. This is Richard's background. Now, Richard finds himself operating in Ukraine, and he's going to talk about what he's seeing on the ground. So in our talk today, we discuss the Amnesty report. We also talk about what it is like to work in a war zone. We talk about philanthropic and other governments' ideas about what should happen in war zones and then in post-war development.
Frontier Operations, we deployed to Ukraine first week of the war because it was clear there was a not just a war, but a humanitarian crisis unfolding. And we opened a Ukrainian company to serve Ukraine for the long term. So it's a security operations, defense, and logistics platform. A, we can help private companies that need to move around, news crews, you know, companies re-entering. But more importantly, it's to serve the NGO community and other people that are coming in to serve Ukraine so that we can do all of that operational planning for them. We know the country, we have networks, we can get them into contested areas. So we get the specialist in what they do to help Ukraine to the place they need to be. And they don't have to think about anything else, you know, because we have the knowledge, we have people with vast amounts of experience in conflict and complexity, importantly, because Ukraine is incredibly complex, to create that platform that they can just come into. They don't need to worry about anything else. And we take them to the place where they can do their work. And everything we do is geared towards helping Ukraine and the people that want to help that country.
For people who are not familiar with operating in conflict zones, you give a few very solid examples of how you assist these efforts.
Yeah, so I can't tell you too much about too many. You know, we were supporting one of the war crimes investigations team that was funded by the US State Department because they were coming in to support the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian prosecutor general to investigate war crimes. Of course, there's thousands and thousands and thousands, and they need to be at the point of crime as quickly as possible. So it's very reactionary. And we were providing them with all of their intelligence reporting. So like, this is the risk reporting. You know, this is what's happening here. So this is how we're going to mitigate the risk for you. But we're also providing the proactive intelligence. You know, in the military, we call it targeting. So this is what is happening, what's likely to happen. So they can start making operational decisions against that in terms of where they were probably going to be. And we got them into country, we got them set up in country, and then we got them to all the places they needed to get to do those investigations whilst keeping them safe at the same time. That's a sort of example of various parts of the offering suite that we provided. So the world's never seen a conflict like this. You know, the last time we saw a conflict like this, you know, it would have been the World Wars, but there wasn't the level of technology and, I mean, there was propaganda back then, but not on this sort of scale that we have now. And they weren't able to climb into your devices and take information to use against you in that way. So we provide everything from, you know, close protection officers and journey management, because, you know, it's a long way across that country. That's the very lowest level of what we do. But we also provide communication security training, communication security equipment. We plan logistics operations into the contested areas. We even do that when necessary, because it's not just about rolling in there with a load of ex-soldiers. You know, you have to engage with the human terrain. And that's not just Russians. You know, that is who is the power brokers in those areas. And you have to know that, and you have to map it out over time. Who is the influential people? Who do they get on with? Where do their affiliations lie? Because if you're going to just roll in there with food or aid, or, you know, it could be bullets and guns, you have to navigate that corruption. So you, what you don't want to do is give it to the wrong person who's then going to hold it and sell it, and maybe even sell it the wrong way. So, you know, that's a very quick overview of some of the things that we do. In the more complex areas, putting together salvage operations to get things out of Odessa, so bespoke projects, supporting the war crimes investigations team in the way we described earlier. You know, they're expert investigators, but they don't know how to move into Kherson. So we get them into Kherson so they can do that investigation inside the protection we provide, and then we get them out again.
So you're providing essentially a shell of, when they step into the country, the difficult parts, all the little tiny things that people don't know how to navigate, you have that taken care of.
Yeah, I like to sort of say that we create space for people to operate inside the conflict. So we give them the space to do their work. Now, that space can be created physically, it can be created digitally. It can be created through us giving them education, you know, through giving them intelligence reporting, just giving them understanding of what they're doing and where they're doing it. So, you know, space can be physical, it can be digital, and it can be metaphorical.
The work that you were doing in Ukraine was preceded by work you had originally started in a nonprofit.
So we put together an NGO in the UK that was predominantly for military veterans and ex-emergency services. And we retrained them as humanitarian crisis responders. And the mission that we came up with was simple. It was to reach the unreachable. So all the disasters that were happening around the world, the big NGOs, they get the aid to the places it's easy to get them to, that they can do with inside their tolerances. And that doesn't belittle their work. They've done amazing work and they still continue to do it. But it cuts off huge parts of the affected population because it's too hard to get there. You know, up mountains in Nepal, outside floodplains in Beira, inside the liquefaction areas in Indonesia. And so we built an organization deliberately to be able to access all of those areas that inside the NGO structure was unreachable. So the mission was reach the unreachable. And we did that time and time again on, you know, I mentioned three times into Indonesia, twice into Nepal, twice into the Caribbean, once into Mozambique, into the center of Congo, inside the Virunga National Park, you know, and we were this expeditionary, self-sustaining organization that took a military approach. By that, I mean, you know, using the least to achieve the most, you know, and so we could get into all these areas and support ourselves to deliver aid, and which meant we were very cheap as well. And we didn't pay the responders. They were all volunteers because they were getting back something they'd lost in terms of sense of belonging, you know, being part of a mission bigger than themselves, a sense of purpose and service. So they were getting this back in spades. So they were going above and beyond, and they were running at a million miles an hour through these disaster zones because they were going to go back to their life as an accountant or a teacher or whatever after that. So they would just completely expend themselves on this work. So we achieved some incredible outcomes. So that was the preceding 4 years prior to Ukraine. Well, no, so I opened a crisis response company in between, but based on the same model, I left the NGO world to set up this crisis response company. And then when Ukraine happened, because of that background, my phone was lighting up. You know, people asking me, how do we get things in? How do we get money in? How do we get people out? You know, what's going to be needed? I've got all this stuff. Who do I give it to? The phone was just going off the hook. And I looked at on the map where people were telling me they were and things were. And I just decided if I drove over and I jumped in my truck in the UK and I drove over and I drove into Ukraine, if I put myself in the middle of that, I can start to create some coherence and I can start to pull some of these strands together because, you know, one piece of effort here on its own, it'll be far more effective if we start to cohere those lines of effort and we can do something of more meaning. I don't know how long I thought I was going for, but I'm still there. And I've just got my 3-year visa to stay there to continue working. But that's how we ended up there. Again, we went to probably posture against the refugee crisis, but then it very quickly became aid into the contested areas. And then it quickly actually pulled us far more into security operations and defense for those that need to work there.
There was recently a report put out by Amnesty International around July 29th. And the aftermath of that support was a great many people resigning, including the head of Amnesty in Ukraine. And the meat of that report, it was talking about how Ukrainian military essentially were not following international law and international standards while operating during war, and that they were around civilians and making civilians targets. Is that what was happening?
Yeah, I mean, that report, I mean, it's how we met. So, you know, the one good thing came out of it, I guess. But yes, do Ukrainian military occupy civilian buildings? Of course they do. Do they have a choice? No, they don't. And this was my overriding issue with the report. And it lacked all context. It tried to be overly objective. And I think it was falsely objective because international law, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an expert, but there's two factors that come into the accusation they were making. And they left out one of the factors because one of them is you're not meant to use schools and hospitals as firing points. But the other is there is the strategic military imperative about choice because they have to defend the areas that are being attacked. Now, Russia targets schools and hospitals and they target these civilian areas. So the Ukrainian military is not, they are not in a position at the moment where they are choosing the time and place of the engagement. And that's really important because if they were choosing the time and place of the engagement, if they were laying ambushes from these buildings, the report would be fair. But that's not the case. You know, they're a defensive organization. They're in a reactionary mode. And they also have to defend what is being attacked. And that was all left out of the report. And that's where it fell down. And the example they used, and they didn't actually name where this was. You know, they talked about eyewitness accounts. They didn't actually talk about how many. So it can be one. Mm-hmm. Was that one a Russian supporter? You know, it was such a flawed report or such a flawed release of the report anyway. They also portrayed themselves as experts in military doctrine, which they clearly aren't, because they suggested instead of using the hospitals or the schools, there was a nearby woodblock that they could use. But of course, if the assault is coming onto you and you're in a school and then you overhear, what you've done is you've opened the door. And Russia has been taking hospitals out systematically to put more stress into the Ukrainian system. And any person that has any idea of conflict and any idea of fighting in an urban area would understand that. And it lacked all of the prevailing context of the conflict and the way that it's working. And it implied, it didn't necessarily directly accuse, but it certainly left the implication to an uneducated reader that the Ukrainian military was hiding behind human shields. And that is fundamentally wrong. You know, the only human shield in Ukraine is those soldiers with the rest of the population behind them. You know, I'm sure we're going to talk quite a lot about it. I mean, that's the direct answer to that question.
When I was reading this report, I'm an academic. So these are what you mentioned. Those are the criteria where I'm always looking. Who are you talking to? What methods did you use? Who was doing the questioning? Who's doing the interview? How did you collect the data? I look at all of those things because every single factor like that has an effect on what the final product is and how the final product is presented. And so academics are kind of crucified for this, for being very laborious in their reporting. However, when you look, when you have these questions, all of those questions are answered because we are very rigorous in social sciences. But I do qualitative, which is what this was. And you have to be very rigorous in your methods and in describing the methods because these questions come up. It's exactly, who are you talking to? Yeah. And when I was reading it, it seemed very anecdotal and trying to think of a nice way to say thin, like just thin on the
shallow. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So what you're saying, that's very much how I read it and interpretation of it. So there's the information and then there's what's being conveyed. What are you supposed to take from this information? Mm-hmm. And it very much to me read as if Ukrainians are using human shields.
Yeah. And you know, you're an incredibly intelligent lady who understands the subject matter. So you can read that and you can start to pull apart all of those layers that you just described and what was missing. I'm not an academic by any means, but I understand conflict. I understand Ukraine. I've been living that war for the last 6 months. And I have a bit of background in, you know, other international issues and NGOs. So I can pull it apart. But Amnesty has a responsibility way beyond. I think they they didn't understand their responsibility properly there, because they put out a report with this sort of, I keep calling it falsely objective fact, you know, but it was thin, methodology wasn't there, which can be interpreted by other people that don't have your background or my background in a completely different way. And part of me feels that was potentially deliberate, but you know, you saw me write on LinkedIn about it, and you saw the hundreds of replies, and you could see the two sides of that interpretation. And you could see how the pro-Russian, whether they were bots or trolls or, you know, just pro-Russian, you could see how they used that report to further their agenda. And you could see also how they, to back up the report, they're providing quotes from other websites, but the quote was a direct excerpt from the report in which we were criticizing, you know. And it's the danger of putting out something like that. And I think Amnesty fell well short of meeting their responsibilities there, because if you and I write something, if I can write anything I want on the internet, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to shift the opinions of millions of people. It's not going to be used to hurt millions of people. Amnesty bear that responsibility, and I think they failed.
The person who resigned, the woman who was running Amnesty in Ukraine, what she said was it was a lot of what you just said. She said, these people are skilled at evaluating conflict. However, and this is something that happens with NGOs a lot, they fail to take into account the local context. Mm. And she said Amnesty in Ukraine had been doing really solid work for years. They were not contacted. They were not consulted. And there was absolutely no coordination with the international and with the local. In addition to that, the ability to respond.
Was this when they gave the Ministry of Defense 2 days to respond?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So completely unrealistic. And what this does, not only in this situation, but now that Amnesty has done something that has seriously undercut their credibility by anybody who's looking at it, it now calls into question all of their prior work and all of their future work. They are no longer what they were.
Yeah. It's a bit like when a police officer gets found out to be corrupt or criminal. What that does then is every case that police officer has ever presided over and charged comes into question. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's the same thing. I think they have damaged their credibility forever. You know, nothing's forever, but you know, but there's going to be a huge question mark over everything they write now. And I can imagine the excuses they would give, or the reasons they would give, to exclude the Ukrainian office. Too close to the problem. They're a Ukrainian. We want to be completely impartial and neutral. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that at some point. So I can imagine that's what they would say. But what they did then was cut out all of the local context, all of the local understanding. You know, they made it look nefarious because they completely boxed off the in-country office, who were Amnesty. And in any investigation like that, the MOD in any country would have to be part of that investigation. They would have to answer the questions around the prevailing context of the fight. And, you know, before making the judgment, why were none of the military commanders, at least the local military commanders, questioned on why that building was used? Or, you know, what was the circumstances that led to that occupation? Mm-hmm. Because it may have been the Russians were in that building. I don't know. I'm conjecturizing a bit, but, you know, but you have to have that context. You know, it may have been the Russians on the other side of that road, and that was the only opportunity. That was the only option available. We'll never know, because those questions were never asked. And the damage is done to those that want to use it to damage. And the damage is done to Amnesty for people like you and I and many others. You know, we've seen the backlash. And it leaves so many questions in my mind why they did it, because they're not incompetent. They're certainly not stupid. This is Amnesty International. These are bright, academic, long-standing humanitarians who believe in this. So it leaves just too many questions in my mind.
Right. The question of completely excluding the local context for the purpose of being impartial is fundamentally flawed. You are choosing to be partial by omitting possible information that could be useful to you. If you have a rigorous process, you would be able to take in the information and sort through what you were given. That is, if you had a solid method. Don't eliminate possible useful information under some very strange principle of neutrality. That's negligence. That's something different.
It is. And in military planning, and I still use it now, we talk about don't situate your appreciation. So don't come into an estimate process where you're bringing information in with an idea of already what you want. You have to come in with an open mind to the information that you're going to receive so that you can make decisions based upon that. if you situate the appreciation, you're only going to look at the information that further strengthens your preconceived view of what you want to do. And you've got to be very aware of yourself to do that, you know, because we all have a natural natural tendency to reinforce bias or reinforce our egos or our ideas. But they essentially situated their appreciation by cutting out the Ukrainian context. And context is so important in this world, more than it's ever been. You know, you take a line out of someone's sentence, take it out of context, and you know, it can get people fired and put in jail. Put it back into context and it means nothing. And so what they did was to reinforce how neutral and how impartial they were. They situated the appreciation there because they were looking, a sense, to put something together critical of Ukraine to show how goddamn neutral they are. We're so neutral, we'll even criticize Ukraine. That's irresponsible. Because it was, whilst potentially factually correct, there might have been soldiers in that building, we don't know. Because the methodology to show how they came to that wasn't there. Right. It might be factually correct, but it's contextually void of any information.
I'm going to take this into a different context post-war. Hmm. I was with a group on a trip, and it was post-war development. So I was with some people who were Lutherans from the Lutheran Church. And in this country, the Lutheran Church is powerful. But there was a specific instance of a white woman who was handing a woman who belonged to the country. She had $20 in her hand. And this is a fortune to the girl she's handing it to. Mm. And she's saying, but she keeps doing this, and then she keeps pulling it back, and keeps lecturing her on making better choices. The blatant facts were Patrice was the recipient of the $20 by and by. Right. So Patrice had 4 children to 4 different men. She also lived with a man she wasn't married to. Mm-hmm. According to Lutherans, this is no good. Mm. The context of that was they were in Liberia. They were in a war. She had raped multiple times. 4 of those times resulted in pregnancies. Yeah. With the man now, because if she lived with him, at least she got raped by one man.
Oh, God.
Gang raped at will by anyone.
Oh, my God.
So the same thing. You take out of context what you're talking about and just present the facts. And these are very different stories.
Because I want to say that's an excellent example, but of course it's not. It's terrible. It's awful. It's a very powerful way of highlighting the importance of context and understanding and what cold facts, how weak they are when they lack context.
That's exactly it. And this need to simplify things, to put it into something that's easily comprehensible for the public. If you would talk about that now, what the costs of this kind of report are to people?
I mean, first, I don't think the report was neutral or impartial because of positioning the way it was mm-hmm. pro-Russian. So they failed in meeting impartiality and neutrality. So in a disaster response, everyone's a victim. And I don't mean that as in, that can be a pejorative term. But that disaster was inflicted upon all of them, no one's fault. But when you look into a conflict zone like this, there is one state actor that is the clear aggressor. They have invaded a sovereign nation. So I get a tendency to use quite strong language in this. But
go ahead.
But impartiality and neutrality can fuck off there because, well, this isn't a macro victim area. You know, there is one person, there is one nation that was invaded. And that was the choice of another. Now, you can debate who made those choices for Russia to invade. And, you know, we keep saying this is one man. It's not, because we see the actions of those soldiers every day. And there is following orders. And then there is doing the other stuff. There is going the extra way. And I was dealing with a case last night of I won't say where from for obvious reasons, but we're trying to deal with the extraction of a 16-year-old girl who had been imprisoned for the last week by Russian soldiers and repeatedly raped and then released once she was just too weak to carry on. Now, that is not Putin directly. That is Russian soldiers. They are making choices in that. So when I see the humanitarian community crippled at the moment in their response because of impartiality and neutrality, I want to bang their heads together. Like, you have to pick a side, because these people had no choice. They were displaced in 2014 by the Crimea invasion and the Donbass invasion. So they lost everything then. They moved back 50 kilometers. They've been displaced again. They've lost everything repeatedly, and they've tried to rebuild, and it's happened to them again. And they've taken a country. Ukraine has its issues. Every country's got its issues. but it's a beautiful country full of incredible people that want better. You know, they're trying to move the country forward. And the suffering and the devastation that we've seen, and then to see that report that talks about impartiality, no, this is not the place for it. You have to pick a side and you have to get to work for that side. Russia made their choice, and they're making choices every day to the most tactical level to be evil, you know, true evil that I didn't see in Afghanistan. And I saw some really evil things from the Taliban. But there was such a cultural void between us and the Taliban. You know, they, you know, Sharia law and the prehistoric views around that. Obviously, I'm polar opposite to that, but that was their culture and their view. We're talking about a country where they own houses in London and Monaco, and they can travel freely, and they go on holiday, and they've got football teams and computer games, and they're like us, and they can exert this level of evil on innocent people. So there is no place for impartiality and neutrality here. It's completely devoid. And I think they use the humanitarian sector is sitting on those principles to avoid them having to do too much and take too much risk. And I think they face this existential crisis around Ukraine because of it.
As we're talking, there is so much just below the surface that is remaining unsaid. Mm. And I'm wondering if you will say it again, because there's so much disinformation. People aren't there and they're not seeing what you're seeing. So when you say evil, you just mentioned about the kidnap and gang rape of a girl. What else is going on? What exactly are you seeing? Because I loved how you just framed that. They have houses in London. They have houses in Monaco. Like these are otherwise people. These are people that you would see at a nice place having champagne, and you might be sitting next to them.
Right.
I've been in these places. I'm curious what's going on.
We are seeing, bring it out of the abstract and to make it crystal clear. We are seeing weaponized rape and weaponized murder across the whole of that conflict zone, from women that, you know, of varying ages, but women to babies and everything in between. I have never experienced anything like it in my life on a scale that we're seeing, to the point that it's weaponized. It's a tactic. They're doing it on purpose to terrify and impose. You know, shelling of civilian areas is one thing, and it's I think we all agree it's a bad thing. You know, like indiscriminate killing. But we've sort of seen that from Russia and Syria. You know, the siege of Aleppo, they just bombed it until it wasn't there. And then we saw it in Mariupol. You know, we've seen it in Severodonetsk. But it's what they do when they close into these towns, and we're seeing children who have witnessed their father pulled from a car, executed in front of them, their mother raped in front of them, and they're turning up to an orphanage. And these are children that are 5, 6 years old, and they're presenting with gray hair because of the trauma they've experienced. And we're seeing trauma across a population, again, that I've just never witnessed. Talking to people in cafes and bars, and they just start to break down. And so we're seeing the kind of combat trauma that we saw in soldiers from Iraq, Afghanistan, and previous conflicts, of course, but in people that were trained in some way to start to deal with that trauma, we're seeing that level of combat trauma and also combat injury. You know, if you go to the hospitals, you're seeing women presenting with horrific double amputees, triple amputees from getting shelled in their garden, but it's the trauma, and it's at a grand scale across a population because they are all seeing the horrors of one of the most brutal conflicts our generation has ever seen.
This is something, even say it ended today, that's 1 to 2 generations who will not recover from that.
Ever. You can't. You cannot recover from that. The loss is too great. And what you have seen is too... They were living a normal life. This wasn't a gradual... 23rd of February, they're in Starbucks. You know, they're just living a normal, essentially Western European style lifestyle, because the Ukraine is very, well, most of the country is very Western European. And then they were then exposed to trauma that you just can't describe. You know, tanks, planes, soldiers rolling through their houses, murdering indiscriminately and leveling cities. They'll never recover from that, no matter how strong and resilient you are. From normal, doing the school run, to that, there's no way you can ever return to normal.
The use of weaponized rape is not new to here. It's something that's been implemented for a long time. And what's really different about Ukraine conflict? I've heard this in many framed many different ways, but how you just said you're sitting in Starbucks one day, the next day you're being bombed in your garden, your children are being kidnapped, you're losing limbs. We've never seen this happen to white people.
Yeah, race is an issue.
This has happened. What's that?
Race is a factor here.
The quickest way, in especially in African societies, the quickest way to dismantle the social fabric, rape the women.
Yeah.
So they'll do it in the public sphere, sometimes cut them as it's happening, tearing children from the mother. I'm not saying this in a voyeuristic way. It's nightmares, nightmares upon nightmares upon nightmares of things that horror movies couldn't begin to capture the essence of what this is. And this is what has happened to generations of people.
Yeah.
But because they don't look like us, we think that's normal. We think they just do that to each other. I don't think that, but I'm saying like, this is a general feel. So then when you imagine that these are people who look like you, it's a different kind of reality because you never thought it could happen to you because those people who have it happening to them, they don't look like you. They're in a different place. It's just like reading science fiction.
Yeah. This is a huge, and it's a delicate subject, but you're absolutely right. Well, I think you're right. It's the most people haven't been to sub-Saharan Africa. I have lots. I've done lots of work there, and so I understand what you're talking about. And I've unfortunately been exposed to that. Most people sitting in America, England, France, Germany have not. So it's not just that it's because they don't look like us. It's also because they have no reference point. Probably that it happened. They've heard it, but it's more than abstract. It's like you've studied this. You know, you're an academic. I've been there. So you and I have a slightly different understanding of it, but it still catches me. And I think I'm reasonably self-aware, and I think I'm reasonably well-traveled and aware of the world and what it is. But it still catches me because this is like being in Ukraine is like being in London. And so it's not just that they look like us, it's that everything around looks like home. But absolutely, did the outpouring of support to Ukraine sort of demonstrate how racially biased we are? Yes, it did.
So I'm curious, right? So let's go back to Ukraine and what you are seeing, some lack of effectiveness.
You want me to talk about the lack of effectiveness in the humanitarian response?
Yes.
Yeah. So we've been there since day six. Day seven, something like that. And we first of all mounted on the Polish border, expecting it to be a refugee crisis. But that was actually very short-lived because the refugees got absorbed into the fabric of England very, very quickly. And it was an acute problem, not a chronic problem. So having surveyed that for a couple of days, I mounted into Ukraine. Now, I was expecting to see the NGO machine starting to turn, you know, the cluster system starting to form, the UN with OCHA, which is the Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, that's their emergency response organization. And it's probably the best part of the UN. I'm not necessarily a huge fan of the UN, but OCHA is a particularly punchy, has a slightly military culture about it in terms of the expeditionary nature of the work they do. And I was expecting all of that to be spinning up, Red Cross, Oxfam coming in, and the silence was almost deafening in terms of looking around. It's just not there. And OCHA is established in Dnipro, and some of the bigger UN programs are established in Kyiv, but they were there already. You know, the development programs, the World Health Organization, you know, there's big development projects. They were already in Kyiv, but you look around for the rest and they're just not there. And then you look at those ones that are there with I don't know the exact figure, but we know it's way over the millions. You know, we're into billions of dollars of aid has been sucked up into these organizations, you know, the cartel of NGOs that sit on all this cash, and because they can launch these huge campaigns. You and I sitting at home, people like us, we can expunge our feeling of guilt by putting 500 quid in it, and we've done our bit, and it just gets hoovered up on a grand scale. But what we're seeing, and it's what we always see, is who and what is delivering is small, organic, localized NGOs. They're taking all the risk, they're doing all the service, and they're doing it with no financial support. And I've been to see small community groups that form together to create food banks for internally displaced people, and they're every day handing out bags, and they're trying to be so efficient so that people don't have to queue for a long time because the indignity, you know, they're trying to preserve these people's dignity. So when they say turn up at 10, the food's already all laid out in different bags. And the people turn up at 10, and in 15 minutes, the whole line's been done and they're off, and they can try and maintain some of their dignity. But they're doing it on a shoestring. They're begging, they're borrowing, and there's millions, probably billions, sat in these cartel NGOs. And they'll just sit on that for a long, long time. And they'll come in when the conflict's pretty much over. And then they'll come in and they'll start spending on a huge grand scale, but not effectively. They'll be spending on... They'll be spending on having their presence there, and their metric will be how little they spend the money. So they'll be spending in huge chunks to get it out the door effectively for them, or efficiently. Efficient and effective is different. Efficiently. But what's the efficacy of the programs they're delivering? Because actually you need, I think, and I've always thought this, programs built up of micro projects, because it's the micro projects that are really effective. But it's more motivation for them, so they don't do it. And they just chuck it out in huge handfuls to the same old organizations that, to my mind, aren't fit for muster anymore.
The NGO model that you just mentioned, a lot of different micro projects, that's not really attractive to funders. Funders like you to be able to say what you're going to do, like the miracle that you're going to create that will never actually happen. But exactly as you said, small operating costs, big results. You have a company, you have a private company. So, you know, without appropriate staff, without appropriate infrastructure, you would never be able to deliver the services that you do. And there are a lot of small details that go into being able to provide the space that you are able to provide. Mm. So those are administration costs. Mm. When it comes to, when it comes to the funders, do you think they're doing work out of their car? You think that's how they build their money? No. But then when it comes to the NGOs, yes, if you have too many support staff, they won't have this. If you take too long to make a decision, won't have this. If the program seems too complex, they won't have this. Mm. This is what I studied for my dissertation, are all of the reasons that funder, like among other things, all the reasons that funders will cut your money.
Yeah.
This is part of it.
Yeah.
So, something like you just mentioned, a lot of different organic programs, what that allows is for a great deal of flexibility, and it allows you to be adaptable to what the needs are on the ground. The funding models, however, are you make a grant proposal, you say, I'm going to do steps 1 through 10. So they say, okay, sounds good, we'll do that. So you get to step 2, there's a flaw, there's a problem. Step 3 is not going to happen, let alone step 10. But you've said you're going to do this, so you have to stay the course. All the money, 80% of the money will be wasted now because it's flawed. And there's no way in my research, there are, of course, people who do things differently. But in my years of philanthropy, in my deep interviews with private donors, that flexibility is not always available to NGOs.
It's never available to NGOs, but that doesn't make it right. And it doesn't mean that they shouldn't challenge it to change it or find a way to change it. But of course, they're incentivized to get that money because that's what keeps the lights on.
That's their job.
Yeah. Are they incentivized to challenge and fight for what is a better outcome? Now, I think it's about the outcome. I've always thought it's about the outcome, which is probably why I don't sit on millions of pounds anymore. I'm too focused on the outcome. But some years ago, I wrote an op-ed and in the Telegraph here, it's a big paper in the UK, criticizing DFID. We just responded to Mozambique and we've done some incredible work on no money. And the UN, the OCHA team, had to use us extensively to get to all the places that none of the big NGOs could get to because they didn't have the risk tolerances, they didn't have the ability. And we did it for pennies on the pound, pennies. I've written and applied and phoned everyone I knew in DFID, which is our Department for International Development, you know, many times. And then we'd just done this thing and I got the same old sort of stiff arm away. So I was like, okay. So I wrote an op-ed in the Telegraph and it got printed. It was highly critical. The next day, DFID's on the phone. They're like, what do you want? Like, are you going to do another? I said, well, we might, you know, but because we kept getting palmed off. So they agreed to give me a meeting with the Secretary of State, which was Rory Stewart at the time. Now, Rory Stewart, former soldier for a short time, But he walked across Afghanistan on his own. He's written loads of books. He's a hell of a character. He, you know, there's lots of suspicions that he might have been a spy, but he's lived a life. And all of the coaching we were receiving was Rory Stewart, who was new in seat as the Secretary of State, will love your organization. He'll love what you do, who you do it, and how you do it. And it's probably a bit naive going to the meeting because I thought it was going to be me and Rory having a chat, you know, like you do with the Secretary of State. Because I walk in and the whole staff is down this huge table, all the civil servants, and he sort of sat at the top. And I go to speak, and he said, "No, hang on, wait." And then each one of them, because they knew what I was going to say, so they all closed off the argument ahead of time, and I watched it all just slipping away from me. I was getting my pants pulled down, and then you know, at the end, I was like, "Okay, I'm losing here." I used to box, and you know when you're losing a fight and you've got to come out swinging. So I was like, okay, but I've had enough. And I just went for it. And the meeting came to a close, and he did say to me at the end, because I think he and I probably did have a lot in common, but he was a Secretary of State. So he had to follow the rules. But there was just enough in what he said to me afterwards. And it was almost like a little pat on the back. It was that, you know, we have all this money, but to give you 1 million costs the same amount of time and effort as it costs to give Oxfam 100 million. So we're going to give it to Oxfam.
That is a perfect example of what encapsulates my headache, my continual headache.
I'm glad we share the headache, because a problem shared is a problem half.
I don't know if there's a professional term for it, but you know, that factor that just makes your head want to explode. When you hear this kind of rationale, because you always think when these things are happening, they're happening on a big scale, that somebody somewhere is making really smart choices. Mm-hmm. Somebody in the room is making really reasonable, responsible, informed decisions. Mm. If I think hard, I might be able to think of a couple examples of that to mind. I've always been very shocked when I get into a room and I see how the decisions are made. Mm. Interesting.
Yeah. And because I used to think that, you know, as a young Marine, you know, follow the flag, follow it, because someone way smarter than me is making these decisions. Uh-huh. The more you joust with the system and the more you see into it, you realize it's not. And there's a huge amount of mediocrity and inadequacy in there. And they don't make decisions based on what's the best outcome. They're also making decisions on what's best for their career progression.
Yes,
and,
yes.
You know, and how we're incentivized is often how we make decisions. And they're not going to die in the ditch on a decision that's ultimately going to jeopardize their career on the whole. There's some, but then they often don't last very long because they're seen as renegades, rogues, whatever. But I think we need a few more renegades in this world now.
I agree. So now this tension, because you're in this room, you can do what people consider impossible and you're there to articulate it. With funding, it could have happened. But you have a lot of people who already planned for you. They've already decided what the outcome is. How do you deal with that tension?
Tension in terms of the frustration.
Right. Those constraints that seem almost inhumane. They are inhumane constraints considering what could happen.
I think my time as a CEO of an NGO of a disaster was probably the hardest, most rewarding often, but the hardest time of my entire life because of that. The systems that we were trying to access were designed to protect the systems. So, you know, you're coming into the UK central government to ask for money because disaster response was built in a way 50 years ago, 60 years, whatever, to deal with those problems. But the problems have changed. The face of the disasters we were meeting had changed. The way the response had to happen had changed. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to this system to convey that. And you know, I think I'm reasonably convincing. I think I can convey a point, but they didn't want to hear the point because the system is designed to protect the system. It's designed to prevent change. Mm-hmm. And so you become this tiny thing banging your head against it and screaming into a vacuum. So it becomes incredibly frustrating and it can become incredibly disillusioning. We were faced with an option of just going down that road and becoming bitter and or changing what we did to fit the model, which I refused to do because what we were doing was the thing that can deliver the outcome. So I wasn't going to become the thing that I was so critical of in terms of its lack of ability to evolve and change. So we opened a commercial entity inside the organization, which provided the same kind of services that we could do as a charity on a consultancy basis to private organizations for crisis response and that kind of thing. And so we made our money that way, and all of the money gifted back into the charity. So we created a self-fulfilling organization, which meant then we could be even more punchy and even more expeditionary, because then we weren't spending donor money and we weren't asking for donor money. So we could do exactly what we thought was right instead of what a donor might want us to do. Back to the points you made earlier. Had that failed, I don't know. I'd have drunk a lot more probably, because you feel powerless eventually.
You said something very cool in another podcast, and then you mentioned it here a bit too. So with the people who are working for you, and then in the context you're working in now, you were mentioning about after the war, then you're looking for a job and you're dying because you have to put on this stupid gray suit and show up every day. You know, you can feel your soul draining out of you, having to go with a financial responsibility and work in this very different space. Mm. And what you said was, you were talking about military. You said, I made sense in that space. Mm. And then when you're talking then about the volunteers, the people who are going into these really difficult, gritty, these situations that other people who wouldn't have been you or them would never even imagine going into, let alone to make a plan to do it. That's what you're saying too, is like, this is, they can get away from being an accountant for a few days. They can kind of come back to the essence of who they are and thrive space where it makes sense there. Mm. I'm curious how much that drives you in your work.
I mean, it drives me completely, but I think I'm very lucky that life has unfolded in a way that I can. Not everyone can, you know, I don't have children and, you know, they're kind of responsibilities, and I earn enough money to live the life that I want to live. And it's a very comfortable life. You know, I'm entirely happy with the way it plays out for me. But when I ended up in the bank as an investment banker after the Royal Marines, I didn't make any sense there. I was reasonably effective by all of the metrics of success that gives you. They pay you more money. They promote you quite quickly. And you're getting pats on the back and you're getting invited out for drinks with senior people. That's the only metric you really get, because there's no actually feeling of achievement, or not for me anyway. And it was at that kind of time I realized I'm just not motivated by money. I'm motivated by what I do and who I do it with. And it has to mean something, and it needs to be connected to the world in some way. And it needs to be connected to doing good. And like I said, I know that I make sense to myself in conflict zones and in very complex, difficult environments where most people don't want to be. They might be capable, but they just don't want to be there. Well, I do, because actually I derive pleasure from the fact that most people don't want to be there. But I derive much more pleasure from the sense of service and really leaning in hard to do good. You know, it probably tracks back to being bullied as a kid and now being a bigger, more capable guy, and you know, the sort of microcosm of standing up for the little person there. You know, I think that makes a lot of my life view and how I operate and how I work. And I see that across my cohort of friends that joined the military. We didn't join the Royal Marines for money. You know, I don't think we even knew what we were going to get paid when we joined. It's a calling. It's a pull. It's a family. It's a thing. You know, it's beyond a vocation. You know, they say commandos are born, and there's this, when you look across that cohort of mine, and I'm incredibly lucky with the friends I've got and the people I've got to work with in this last 20 years because of the jobs I've done, apart from that 3 years in the bank, forget about that, is that there is this sense of service and wanting to belong to something bigger themselves. And it's like, it's in their DNA. It's like, it's molecular. But I get calls probably once or twice a week from mates or mates of mates asking how I put this life together, because they just miss it. You know, they miss the extraordinary nature of the people you get to do things with and the sense of doing something good, yeah. Something that you're proud of. Now, what I think is good might be different to you, but it doesn't matter, because it's me. You know, I think I'm doing the right thing and I'm proud of it. And that's actually what fulfills me, because, you know, happiness is a load of bollocks. You know, we're not all meant to be happy all the time, but we should be fulfilled. You know, we should be living a life where we make sense to ourselves and we are proud of that. And we don't have to over-exaggerate or lie about ourselves to please other people that we don't care about. And that's what I mean by making sense in that space. I made sense in Afghanistan. I made sense in the Royal Marines to myself. I make sense in this environment because it fits. My brain works in that environment. It's stimulated. I understand it. You know, people like me understand it. We see it, we feel it. And, we have senses and we have intuition and we have judgment and we have patience, where lots of people get overwhelmed by the environment, so they don't make good decisions. Whereas we don't get overwhelmed by it. We thrive upon it. We seek it and we love it. Does my mom love the fact that this is the way I've turned out? not so much. But she does recognize that it is me. And she would rather I do this than try and force myself into something normal where I don't make sense. Because then you get all the downsides of being a veteran. You start to drink too much. You know, your mental health probably suffers. You become a bit chippy. You know, I'm continuing to live a life that makes sense to me. And that's what I think I was probably talking about in other podcasts, and what I saw across this cohort of people who were doing it as well for free, just short periods of time.
I did an interview. It was for a research project, and they were talking to peacemakers, and it was very similar. It's funny, war, but peace. It's a calling. The money's not terrific. You may or may not be appreciated. Usually the people close to you really don't appreciate it, but you can't not do it because that's what you're meant for. Yeah. So these ideas of maybe like what mom would like, the very regular, a life that would make somebody else very fulfilled with having children, with having steadiness. I would kill myself. I would not like that at all. Yeah. I actually planned my life. I've been very averse to children because it ties you down.
Yeah.
I call a lot of names for that, but that's not a life I'm trying to have. I need to do what I need to do.
Yeah.
So when you said that, it really resonated. That's cool. I mentioned about the astrology before.
Yeah.
You have a face that's Mars.
Mars.
Vulcan, Aries, war. Yeah. So you have that on your chin and you have the jawline. Yeah. But you have a very Mars face.
Okay.
I would guess your profession, but I would definitely guess your chart. Yeah.
My face has been quite altered over the years by the sports and activities I've chosen to undertake, unfortunately. Maybe I wasn't always Mars, but.
No, you can't. It didn't redo your jawline. It didn't redo your basic features.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything that you would like to say in closing, or kind of any thoughts to wrap up?
I think I would just urge anyone that listens to try and maintain focus on Ukraine, and to try and maintain Western focus on Ukraine, because that war is not really changing in intensity, but it certainly is in terms of publicity. And that conflict is more important to any of us than I think most people realize. It will be generationally defining, but it's just not in the headlines. So I just encourage people to maintain the right level of focus on that. And because that in turn maintains pressure on politicians to do the right thing. The moment we don't care about something, they don't need to act on it. As long as we can make sure that we care about it, they'll keep acting.
From your perspective, where would you recommend that people go read, listen for useful information to talk about this conflict?
That's such a good question, because it is hard to get cut through. I do recommend going to security companies' websites and LinkedIn pages and subscribing to newsletters. I actually publish ours for free at the moment. So if they follow Frontier Operations on LinkedIn, we'll send them out for free. But there's lots of other good ones out there. I'm talking more from the British perspective at the moment, because I don't know many of the American companies, but Prevail Partners provide excellent intelligence reporting. You've just got to give them your email, because obviously you're in the database, but they send it out free each week. Sibylline International do some fantastic stuff. So the security companies, I think, is a fantastic way to get real information, because they are using that as value-based marketing to bring more clients in. So they spend a lot of time doing that work. I forget what it stands for, RUSI, but the International War Studies Institute is also very good. They publish every day. Google RUSI, RUSI, they're fantastic. Chatham House, really good. You know, because what you're doing there is you're going to respected institutions that understand conflict on a global scale, and they're sucking up information and they're analyzing the veracity of it to fuse it into intelligence. Because there's a difference between information and intelligence, you know, because information can be fake, whereas intelligence implies they've fused it, they've checked the veracity of it, and then they've created intelligence from it. So I'd be focusing on those kind of sources. I would definitely be staying away from Facebook, LinkedIn newsfeed, Instagram, Telegram, any of those kind of places. Go to somewhere where they're being fused and analyzed.
Richard, why is this conflict so important?
I mean, Ukraine's the breadbasket of the world. You know, people are starving in Africa because of this conflict right now. Fuel prices have gone through the roof. But it's not that. It's a clear attack on democracy, isn't it? And I know that means a lot more to the American people than it does the British. This is an aggressor attacking democracy, looking to rebuild the USSR. And if they're not stopped in Ukraine, they're going for Poland, they're going for Estonia. And we are very quickly, we're already economically in World War III, but we're very quickly moving towards a full-scale World War III that will be fought out in the continents of Africa, Europe and Asia, the same way the Second World War was. And that will affect all of us because the death toll will be astronomical, you know, way more than World War II.
Now, on that really very happy note, thank you. It's a really frightening and really solid summary. So thank you.
No, thanks.
Thank you for joining us. Our guest was Richard Sharp, the CEO of Frontier Operations. If you'd like Richard's information, you can find it below in the show notes. If you'd ever like to be a guest, please contact me. That information is in the show notes as well. As always, I leave you in peace and sincerely wish you the day you deserve.